Morning. Was it mentioned in the gathering that this is the last Sunday that we have the choir until our summer break? Are we going to miss them? Yeah. I think so. The life of faith for we disciples of Jesus, as these songs we've sung and these scriptures we've read remind us, are filled with struggles and victories, are filled with disappointments and joys. They're informed by traces and signs of God's grace and mercy in our lives. Moments, places, peoples, scriptures, communities. Sometimes these signs and these traces wash over us like a flood. But more often, for many of us even, these are the thin threads of grace that we grapple for as we lie awake in the night, whispering prayers of long-shot hope. Maybe I've just shared too much of my own prayer life. Perhaps the most telling sign of all is that in our pursuit of God, despite our very best efforts to miss the point, God gets through to us. He rescues us. He reorients us, challenges us, and he makes us the unlikely participants in this project of restoration for the whole universe even, this project called the gospel. The life of faith for the followers of Jesus is also very much informed by the real, all too present, and persistent forces of evil and destruction in the world. The songbooks of our tradition are full of redemption songs, transformation songs, grace and mercy songs, and for good reason. This is our story. This is our song. But even if we don't often sing them in public, even if they're not typically found in the pages of our songbooks, our story and our song is also informed by the very real realities of bondage and suffering and cruelty in a broken world. Evil still has a footing. Not only because the church is called to embrace God's healing and take God's presence into dark places, but because each of us participates in this messy, tragic comedy called the human history, the human race, where there is no shortage of toil and sorrow, flawed systems, grievous injustice, gushing oil wells, and other heartbreaking headlines. If something as dull as a sermon has anything to say to us, it needs to first serve as a sign pointing to the ways God is on the move, the ways God has worked, the ways God keeps working. The Christian faith does rest in the hope that God is keeping and will keep his promises. But if that same sermon is to have any credibility, if it's to matter to us in any way, it needs to intersect with our lives. It needs to take seriously the world in which we live. It will resist the tidy packages. It can't flinch or look away. It can't gloss over the ugly bits. The sermon isn't allowed to hide under some coats in the narthex, waiting for coffee time and the congregational amen. This may have been what Karl Barth had in mind when he suggested that we should learn to talk about God with our Bible in one hand and our newspaper in the other. In this season after Pentecost, we are presented with scriptures in our yearly readings that flesh out the challenges, the adventures, the gritty realities of what it is to follow this God of ours. Desperate prophets who wait in caves, straining to hear God's voice in sheer silence. The church, struggling to comprehend that revolutionary notion that there is no longer Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female. Psalm 42, which we've heard read today, in which the writer carries the heavy burden, even into church, amidst all the worshipers, writing, "My tears have been my food day and night. Well, people say to me continually, 'Where is your God?' These things I remember as I pour out my soul, how I went with the throng and led them in procession in the house of God with glad shouts and songs of thanksgiving, a multitude keeping festival." In our gospel this week, the gospel of Luke, Luke doesn't flinch. He doesn't look away. He doesn't gloss over the nasty bits. He doesn't present us with a tidy package. He offers us a picture of the living God in action, engaging the very embodiment of evil and suffering, reaching out with healing and grace and, yes, transforming power. At once, in the passage we just heard read, many of us will recognize a healing story. We've seen these before. At least those of us with our Sunday school degrees, I don't think we celebrated those graduates today. There's a pattern to these stories. Jesus meets someone who suffers from a malady or a sickness or an illness of some sort. He heals them, sometimes in a strange and mysterious way. They have a quick talk. The people are amazed, and then he moves on. Make no mistake, these are not parlor tricks. Jesus is not a street magician. He's not performing healings for our entertainment or for the crowd's entertainment. They are what one commentator calls the gospel in miniature. Prophetic demonstrations of what it looks like when God actually gets his way in the world. The story of an individual healing becomes a sign for us of God's intention for all of creation. In verse 26 of chapter 8 in Luke's gospel, we catch up with Jesus and his disciples after they'd just taken the 13-kilometer journey across the lake, leaving behind them the crowds at home in Galilee. They're heading into Gentile country. It's the wrong side of the tracks for these good Jewish boys. On the map of our order of service, you'll find, it's not our bulletin today. There's a map included. You'll find on the one side of the lake is Galilee, the home of devout Jews. Across the lake are the provinces where the disciples would have felt maybe a little nervous, a little out of their comfort zone, the parts of town where mom said not to go hang out. On that relatively short journey, they've been lashed by a sudden storm, and the disciples have witnessed their teacher command the wind and the waves to be still. They were afraid and amazed and said to one another, "Who then is this that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him?" Having come ashore, they meet a man. Well, what's left of a man anyway? A crazed, naked, dangerous, screaming maniac. A wild man. A tortured creature who lives in a cemetery. By any measure, especially a very proper, cleanly Jewish one, this man is disgraced, unclean, untouchable. Maybe it's Luke's economy of words, and no offense to the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible, but the reserved understatement doesn't do this story justice when it reads, "For a long time he wore no clothes and did not live in a house but in the tombs." By all appearances, any shreds of hope or dignity or self or person at all, they're long forgotten. And the townspeople have committed themselves to a sort of first century social work. They commit themselves to this grim routine of catching the man, chaining him up, catching him again when he's broken his bonds. One can't help but wonder, how many times has this ministry of chains been administered? How much longer before someone puts him out of his misery? How much longer before he does the job himself? And then, for me, one of the Bible's most heartbreaking passages. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. Falling at the feet of Jesus is a person without a name, defined instead by the varieties of torment which plague him, named Legion, the designation for 5,000 Roman soldiers. Now, we educated North Americans in the 21st century could be tempted to postulate and hypothesize about Jesus' conversation with these demons or these demonic spirits. Or is this merely the description of first century mental illness, a severe mental illness, mind you? What is the abyss? And why are these demons so afraid of it? Why would Jesus bargain with and extend some sort of mercy to demons of all things? Interesting questions, yes. But here Luke seems quite content to leave us with these loose ends. Besides, as much as these rabbit trails may serve our curiosities, and they may be good fodder for conversation over coffee, they do not constitute the heart of the gospel in this text. If this story, this healing story, is the gospel in miniature, then this man's legion of tormentors points to that great mob of voices and forces which enslave and mutilate our planet and its inhabitants. God's children, human creatures, who wrestle, as the scriptures say, not against flesh and blood, are so often confounded and overwhelmed by personalities, by powers, by forces, big and small, which would lay claim to us, by seductive oppressors who would deceive us. Be it your private, lonely misery, be it a great, systematic, global blight, the varieties of evil and suffering in our world, on our planet, are legion. On the lake, in the boat, the disciples have witnessed Jesus exercise power and authority over the wind and the rain, the elemental forces of creation. Here on the shore, they've witnessed his power and authority over the violent and mysterious forces of darkness and evil in the universe. The implication? Here is yet another sign that this Jesus, Son of the Most High God, has his sights set on bigger and better things. All things, even. This man who restores the one called Legion has power to restore so much more. But then there's this matter of the pigs. Such a strange element of the story. Of course, by all Jewish accounts, unclean animals, as far from kosher as anyone can get. They become the unwitting final resting place of these host of demons. And as a byproduct, a great source of fear for the locals as these pigs stampede into the lake. This herd of swine forms a sort of mad, squealing parade, which carries off this man's tormentors, delivering the demons to their own destruction in a watery abyss of their own making. Well, this punctuates the story with a certain ironic flair. It's a farcical humiliation of evil, even. It generates a number of troubling loose ends. For a start, why would Jesus destroy the livelihood and sustenance of some locals to restore this man? Couldn't he perform the task without all the carnage? Was this a symbolic demonstration of how valuable this man was? From the vantage point of anyone who's, say, ever eaten bacon, or read Charlotte's Web, or watched the classic film Babe the Gallant Pig, is not this noble pig, veritable meal on legs, of more value than some crazed demons? If God sees the sparrow who falls, if he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, isn't a herd of swine worth something? Forgive me if I'm getting overly sentimental here, or I'm betraying my love of all things swine. You may find some commentators here and there who'll venture some educated guesses about these pigs. But as for me, I doubt very much if I'd be satisfied with many of their answers. At the very least, if it's not directly implied by this passage, the calamity of the pigs serves to remind us that when Jesus brings change and restoration and healing, things get messy. Some pigs floating, trotters up in the lake, was really just a warm-up. This is, after all, the very same Jesus who time and again uses this great herd of humans called the church to serve as his messy agents of peace. And make no mistake, in 2,000 years of church history, this has never been a tidy process. The carnage of the pigs quite understandably sends the locals into a frenzy. They're seized with fear, and they send Jesus away. They send Jesus away even after, Luke tells us, they found the man whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. Even with this great evidence of a miracle, their neighbor perhaps, friend, brother, this one they knew as a violent menace, now sits clothed and in his right mind. And yet the people's fear is too great. Jesus is too much to handle. A mystery. Too dangerous a presence. Too financially risky, especially for those with pork belly futures. And so Jesus moves on and heads back across the lake to again walk among the crowds in Galilee. In the aftermath, Luke tells us, the man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might stay with them. But Jesus sent him away saying, return to your home and declare how much God has done for you. So he went away proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. In keeping with our theme of Pentecost, especially for the writer of Luke, who would eventually write the book of Acts, our brief story of Jesus and his journey across the lake has introduced us to the first evangelist beyond the realm of the Jewish world, the first missionary to the Gentiles even. We don't learn his name, but we know that he who was once a living vessel of suffering and evil is now the recipient of dramatic transformation and life-changing grace. The one who ran mad among the tombs now proclaims God's mercies in the city streets. This passage in Luke presents us with a story, a sign pointing to that Jesus, the one who did great things for a suffering soul. But it's also a story how God is at work in the world even today. It points to the Son of God who stands in defiance of the powers of destruction which enslave people. How can I say such a thing? Well, don't take my word for it. Many of you are sitting with us, clothed, and in your right mind, because of the redemptive healing work of Jesus in your lives. We need to hear your stories. Our city needs to hear your stories. Go and declare how much God has done for you. Go and declare how much God has done for you, because there are those even sitting amongst us, hemmed in on all sides by bondage and suffering, too great to name. And this is their story too. Thanks be to God.